From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The largest climate change conference in history is now underway. Delegates from around the world are gathering at a United Nations meeting in Copenhagen to try to work out a deal to reduce carbon emissions. We'll have more on the conference in a few minutes. First, here in the U.S., the Environmental Protection Agency took steps today towards regulating greenhouse gases. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports.
EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson formally declared that greenhouse gases endanger public health and welfare. She cited a long list of global warming's impacts.
The droughts, the flooding, the changes in diseases, the changes in migratory habits, the changes in our water cycle and climate.
Jackson was responding to a 2007 Supreme Court ruling that said the Clean Air Act applies to climate change and not just other types of air pollution. This finding gives Jackson the authority to go ahead with proposed regulations to reduce greenhouse gases from new cars and from power plants and factories. Under Obama administration proposals, by 2016, new cars would have to go an average of 35 miles on a gallon of gasoline. And starting next spring, factories and power plants could be required to start using new technologies to cut greenhouse gas pollution when they expand or construct new facilities.
I don't think there's anyone in the business community that wants EPA to regulate.
That's Jeff Homestead. He headed EPA's air pollution programs under President Bush. Now he represents power companies, manufacturing firms, and other businesses as a lawyer and lobbyist. He says EPA's new regulations will spark lots of lawsuits and create delays for new power plants and other projects.
It's the uncertainty of all of this and the potential slowdown of any kind of economic development that I think is the biggest worry, certainly for my clients.
But environmental activists say the EPA is legally bound to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. Vicki Patton is a lawyer with the Environmental Defense Fund.
It would be irresponsible for policymakers to wait until harm happens before they step in and protect public health.
Professor Michael Girard is the director for climate change law at Columbia University Law School. He says there's no doubt that EPA regulation will inflict pain on some industries.
This would be a long, detailed, cumbersome process, but it would ultimately be effective in reducing emissions from those sources.
But he says it would not be as effective as bills currently being considered by Congress. The House has already passed climate change legislation, but a similar bill is stalled in the Senate. And members have been using the threat of EPA regulation to prod their reluctant colleagues into supporting those bills. EPA's Jackson says that she and President Obama agree that the best way to cut greenhouse gas emissions is for Congress to pass economy-wide global warming legislation. But she stresses that she will do what she can, with or without Congress.
I do not believe this is an either-or proposition. I actually see this as a both-and.
Jackson says she hopes her announcement will send a message to international negotiators in Copenhagen that the United States is committed to facing the challenge of global warming. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
An update now on the swine flu. It looks like the second wave of the flu pandemic of 2009 has peaked in the U.S. 25 states report widespread flu. That's down from 48 a month ago. Hospital admissions and deaths from flu are declining steadily. So are the number of people going to doctors complaining of flu symptoms. And there's new data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, as well as outside researchers, that indicates this pandemic is much milder than expected. Meanwhile, this week, the federal government launched a big ad campaign to convince more Americans to get flu shots. NPR's Richard Knox has the story.
Soon you'll be hearing government-sponsored public service announcements like this one.
This isn't going to be just any flu season, and children are especially at risk for the H1N1 flu virus.
Well, it certainly isn't just any flu season, that's for sure. But the new numbers show the pandemic is far milder than officials expected or have let on so far.
It is probably going to be the mildest pandemic on record compared to the three that happened in the 20th century.
That's Dr. Mark Lipsitch of Harvard. He's one of the authors of a new analysis. It's in the journal called Public Library of Science. There are a number of ways to measure how severe or mild a flu pandemic is. One is what proportion of the population gets sick. So far, it's been less than 8%. Of course, it's not over. Lipsitch says the numbers are uncertain.
But it's reasonable to expect that something between 10 and 20% of our population will become ill with this virus, assuming that the virus doesn't change.
10 to 20%, that sounds like a typical flu season.
It's toward the upper end of a typical flu season, and that's one reason why this virus is turning out to be less severe than was anticipated.
Another measure is the number who get so sick they need hospital care. Lipsitch says if 15% of Americans get this flu,
then we would expect anywhere from about 70,000 up to over 600,000 hospitalizations.
He says we'll probably end up with something in the middle, about where we'd be in a typical flu season. Of course, the most important measure is how many people die. Last spring, experts thought it was entirely possible swine flu would kill 1 out of every 100 people who got the virus.
We now know that that's at least 20-fold too high, and probably more than 20-fold too high.
In fact, the death rate from swine flu so far has actually been less than the average flu season. It's around 1 out of every 2,000 who've gotten sick, maybe less. The big difference this year is that most of these deaths have been among children, teenagers, and adults under age 50. Typically, flu mostly kills people over 65. But that's not because this flu is more severe among children and young adults, as many think. It's simply because many more young people are getting the flu than usual.
The pandemic is making more kids sick, but it's killing a smaller percentage of the kids it makes sick than it is of the adults and seniors it makes sick.
That's Peter Sandman, an expert in risk communication. He says the CDC has been reluctant to acknowledge that swine flu has been much milder than expected.
The CDC may be thinking, you know, there are already millions of people who plan not to get vaccinated because they think the pandemic is mild. And if we announce as the official health agency of the U.S. government that the pandemic is mild, even fewer people will get vaccinated, and some of those people will die.
Not so, says Dr. Thomas Frieden, who's head of the CDC.
I think we've been completely transparent with what we think is happening. I think we have a difference of opinion on whether that is mild or severe.
He points out that the CDC has counted more than 250 deaths among children.
Any flu season that kills at least 3 times more children than a usual flu season, I think it would be very misleading to describe that as mild.
But Frieden agrees perception is what matters. The more that people think the pandemic threat is over, the fewer who get vaccinated. Experts worry that could increase the chance of a third wave of swine flu early next year. Richard Knox, NPR News.
You can follow all the latest health news at our science blog. It's called Shots. Just go to npr.org.
Book critic Maureen Corrigan has assembled her annual list of holiday book buying recommendations. She calls it Suggestions for a Passionate Holiday, and she's definitely not talking about kissing Santa under the mistletoe. Here's her list.
It began to feel to me like an internet version of one of those parlor games, charades or statues, that people supposedly played at Victorian house parties during the holiday season. I had sent a few friends this email. I'm putting together a list of books that people have written about their passions. Can you help with some suggestions? The deluge began. The books I'm about to recommend, mostly slim volumes about places or things that the writers themselves deeply love, made the cut because either I came up with the suggestion myself or I heartily agreed after reading it. This was a big year for the pleasures of the palate, given the popularity of the film Julie and Julia. There are a trillion books on food out there, but if you've never read Laurie Colwin, you must hunt up her 2 unpretentious essay collections called Home Cooking and More Home Cooking. Colwin died at 48 in 1993, and when I try to explain the power of her novels and short stories to people, I usually end up saying, her writing makes me happy, which sounds sappy, but it's true. I picked up her two books on cooking, definitely not my passion, because I had exhausted the rest of her writing. Here are Colwyn's opening words in an essay on coffee. I come from a coffee-loving family, and you can always tell when my sister and I have been around, because both of us collect all the dead coffee from everyone's morning cup, pour it over ice, and drink it. This is a disgusting habit. None of the pleasures Zadie Smith writes about in her terrific, just-published essay collection, Changing My Mind, fall into the disgusting category. They're more endearing, like her prose valentines to Zora Neale Hurston, Greta Garbo, and Katharine Hepburn. This collection also includes some poignant remembrances of David Foster Wallace and Smith's own father, a World War II vet who took part in the Normandy invasion. The great thing about Zadie Smith as a critic is that you get the sense here that her enthusiasms aren't fossilized yet, but are still being formed as she writes. Nonagenarian P.D. James has no doubt been passionate about lots of things in her long life, but to her worshipful readers, and I'm definitely in that multitude, it's her passion for investigating murder most foul that we really care about. In a new little work of criticism called Talking About Detective Fiction, James elegantly surveys the British and American mystery traditions, makes some educated guesses about the future of crime writing, and shares some of her long-tended enthusiasms for, among other writers, G.K. Chesterton. James, of course, lives in England, which would be my number one fantasy choice for where to spend the holidays. Not going to happen anytime soon, but armchair travel is cheap and profoundly pleasurable. I received lots of intriguing suggestions for good books about place, Pico Iyer on Japan, Ishmael Reed on Oakland, but the one recommendation I found irresistible was Mary McCarthy on Florence, because I find any occasion to read Mary McCarthy in all her tart brilliance irresistible. The book is called The Stones of Florence, and in it, McCarthy unveils what was then, in 1956, one of Italy's lesser tourist cities. She loves the handmade shoes, puts up with the then mediocre food, and winces at the sugary vision of the city crafted by Victorians like the Brownings. McCarthy also talks a lot about architecture, and one of the most revelatory appreciations of architecture I've come across is New Yorker critic Paul Goldberger's new book called Why Architecture Matters. This isn't a history of architecture, but rather something more elusive. Goldberger explains, everything has a feel to it, not just masterpieces, but everything in the built world. The purpose of this book is to come to grips with how things feel to us when we stand before them. Goldberger roams from classic masterpieces like the Pantheon to the architecture of memory, like the modest two-family house of his childhood in New Jersey. Any book about great architecture has to discuss the New York City skyline, and the minute I start thinking about New York, I think about E.B. White and his magnificent essay on the city called Here is New York. White wrote it in the summer of 1948 when he'd returned to the city from Maine for a weekend and began to remember how magical New York seemed to him as a young man. Here's the first sentence. On any person who desires such queer prizes, New York will bestow the gift of loneliness and the gift of privacy. On any reader who desires the prize of what I think is the essential essay about New York, E.B. White's Here is New York will bestow the gift of nostalgia tempered with an acceptance of the necessity of change, as well as the gift of an enduring passion.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You can read a list of her suggestions and her complete review on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The White House says there's no silver bullet to solve the nation's unemployment problem, so tomorrow President Obama will try a little buckshot. In a speech in Washington, the president is expected to spell out several proposals designed to encourage hiring. The measures could be funded in part with money left over from last year's bank bailout. We'll hear more about that money in just a moment. But first, NPR's Scott Horsley has this preview of the president's address.
With one in six Americans now out of work or underemployed, the jobs problem touches everyone, even the first family. President Obama spoke in unusually personal terms about unemployment during a visit last week to Allentown, Pennsylvania.
I know times are tough. Michelle and I were talking the other day. There are members of our families that are out of work. You know, we're not that far removed from struggling to pay the bills.
Telling people you feel their pain is one thing. Tomorrow, the president will try to show it. He's proposing a number of additional steps the government can take to encourage companies to hang out the Help Wanted sign.
We need to do everything we can right now to get our businesses hiring again so that our friends and our neighbors can go back to work. So
the White House insists this is nothing new. The jobs have been a top priority for Mr. Obama since the day he took office. Last week, there were signs his earlier efforts are beginning to bear fruit. Big job losses have been tapering off, and Friday, the unemployment rate unexpectedly inched down. That may buy the president a little breathing room, but it will take a lot more to satisfy the millions of people who are still looking for work. Larry Mischel, who heads the labor-backed Economic Policy Institute, says lawmakers are getting impatient.
You know, over the last 5 weeks, there's been a tremendous renewed focus on generating jobs. There's real fire in the Congress to doing something on this right now, and I think the administration has been a little bit slow, but I think they'll catch up.
White House spokesman Robert Gibbs cautions the president will not propose another large-scale stimulus effort. Instead, economic advisor Christina Romer says Mr. Obama is looking at relatively modest steps the government could take that would serve as a catalyst for additional hiring.
At a time when firms are sort of starting to dip their toe into the hiring pond, that might be a time where small actions by the government could get them to just jump right in. And so I think that's really what he's looking for. What are the things we can do soon, targeted, really trying to mainly bring the private sector in from the sidelines?
That might include a tax credit for companies that expand their payrolls, or additional efforts to steer bank loans to cash-strapped small businesses. At a White House jobs forum last week, Mr. Obama hinted he's also likely to propose more incentives for homeowners to weatherize houses and improve energy efficiency, an idea some call cash for caulkers. Ron Sexton, who was at the forum, likes that idea. He's with an Oregon company called Geldwin that makes high-efficiency windows. And he says a boom in replacements could help offset the big drop in new home construction.
America has literally a billion, with a B, of single-pane inefficient windows. Replacing even a fraction of those produces huge energy savings as well as creating jobs, and those jobs can be created immediately.
The administration may have found a window to pay for these programs using funds left over from the $700 billion bank bailout. Spokesman Gibbs says it's likely Mr. Obama will try to use some of that leftover money to encourage job creation. And while the bailout itself was unpopular, Gibbs suggests the reuse of the money should not be.
Help is on the way. It sends the message that your economic vitality is just as important as anybody that lives or works or breathes on Wall Street.
Some Republicans have criticized that idea, saying any and all leftover bailout money should go to reduce the federal deficit. Scott Horsley, NPR News, The White House.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. There's sharp cheddar, and then there's really sharp cheddar. In Wisconsin, a 15-year-old cheddar is now on sale for $50 a pound, and it comes from a pretty sharp cheesemaker, the Hook's Cheese Company in Mineral Point, Wisconsin. The company says it's one of the oldest cheeses you can buy in the country. Tony Hook from Hook's Cheese is with me now, and Mr. Hook, how does this cheese taste?
It's fantastic.
I figured you would say that. Could you describe it for us? I imagine it's not the taste of the cheddar that you might find in the refrigerator aisle in the average grocery store.
Probably not. It's got quite a bit of flavor. It hasn't got any sort of bitterness to it as to what some people would expect for a real old cheddar. And once a cheddar cheese gets past 3 to 5 years, it kind of starts losing that acidic cheddar flavor also. So it just kind of tends to smooth out.
Now, how would one enjoy this?
You'd probably want to just eat it by itself or with a fine wine or a good hearty stout beer.
You wouldn't put it on a cheeseburger?
On a cheese what? Excuse me.
You wouldn't want to put this on a cheeseburger?
No, I don't think so. I don't think you'd want to put it in your mac and cheese, cook it too long and lose some of your flavors.
Now, this has been described as the single malt scotch of cheddar, quite an accomplishment to produce a 15-year-old cheddar. How did you do this?
We have been aging cheddars for over 20 years, and at the time we started, we weren't actually setting out to age anything for 15 years, I guess. But as we aged some of it out and it was developing such good flavor, we decided we'd set some of it aside to age for 12 years and then for 15 years.
People listening to this may wonder, okay, if he's selling 15-year-old cheese, just how old is that cheese that you see at the supermarket that's shredded or in regular packaging?
The stuff you typically see in the shredded packages are maybe 1 to 3 months old. If it does say sharp cheddar on it but doesn't give a year, it's probably less than a year.
Is this your oldest cheese?
This is my oldest cheese I have for sale.
So what does that mean?
I still have a few pounds left of what it was 15 2 years ago, so I still have a few pounds left of the 17-year-old, but that's for personal consumption for the family.
Oh, private reserve.
Yep, not for sale.
Under no circumstances.
I don't even have a label for it.
Oh, don't even ask. Well, all the best to you, sir. Happy holidays.
Thank you. Thanks for calling.
That was Tony Hook of Hook's Cheese Company in Mineral Point, Wisconsin. He was talking to us about his 15-year-old cheddar cheese, now for sale at $50 a pound.
And print media companies are trying to slow their financial descent. Today, several magazine publishers, including Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, are expected to unveil a joint venture. It's a new company that hopes to create technology standards for how magazines will look on e-readers and other digital devices. Ads would have a common appearance, as would the online storefront that consumers would use to buy magazines online. The publications want to stay relevant as people shift from reading articles on paper to reading on devices like the Kindle and the iPhone.
A divorce becomes final this week. Time Warner finishes spinning off AOL as an independent company. That will end the story for what was, just 8 years ago, the largest merger in history. Time Warner was supposed to provide content from its movies and magazines. AOL, the giant web company, would distribute it, and together they would own the world. That's what was supposed to happen. Author Kara Swisher has chronicled what really happened, and she's on the line. Good morning.
How do you do?
So they, through this merger, were going to be the gigantic company. They were even bigger than Time Warner at the time, the gigantic company that was going to bring Time Warner's content to the masses. What happened?
What happened? Humanity happened. There's people involved, and a lot of people didn't like the merger at Time Warner and dragged their feet and didn't do the necessary synergies that were necessary to make it work. Secondly, it was part of a big bubble here in Silicon Valley. AOL was at the top of that bubble. And when it burst and it turned out there weren't quite so many revenues attached to it as people thought, you know, that sort of changed things. And the third thing was it just, you know, people weren't really ready. The Internet was well used at the turn of the century, but Google actually just hardly existed.
So were AOL and Time Warner just ahead of their time?
No, I think it was probably too big. I mean, it was trying to combine these companies, media and the internet. And just as today, there's struggles over, over the music industry digitally, over movies. They're still fighting these fights. So it's still a very difficult marriage for media and traditional media, I guess, and digital media.
So Time Warner now kicks AOL out the door. Mm-hmm. AOL is a much smaller company than used to be in terms of customers and revenues and everything mm-hmm. else. What's the next step for AOL?
Well, it's tough because its main business, the dial-up business, it's declining drastically, and every year it goes down by hundreds of millions more. And they're relying everything right now on content. That's their big play, is the idea of creating content on the internet and selling premium advertising against it. And we'll see what happens, but it's definitely not the size and influence it was before.
So does AOL, in their ideal world, basically become a USA Today for the 21st century?
Kind of like that. They're kind of being like Time Warner a little bit, if you think about it. You know, Time Warner has all those magazines doing that stuff, and not every bit of it's, you know, high-level journalism. A lot of it's People Magazine and Sports Illustrated. So it's a question of how much money you can make at this when a company, say, like Google, is just manufacturing money in the basement there over these little search terms.
How on earth can AOL make money creating its own content and selling it when they apparently couldn't find a way to mine and sell all the content they had access to when they were part of Time Warner?
Well, that's a good question also, but, you know, they didn't get a lot of access to it. That took forever. You know, Time Warner really is run like a separate kingdom, and the magazine people at the time didn't really hand over the goods. And so AOL was never able to take advantage of them in a really substantive way. Same thing happened with the cable business. There was supposed to be a lot of mergers of AOL distributed over cable, over broadband, which was a great idea, but the cable people resisted. The movie people, you know, it just went on and on and on.
Sounds like you don't entirely blame AOL for this failure.
Oh, I do. They were arrogant and rude, and they came in telling people what to do, and they, you know, they had all sorts of questionable issues around their revenues that sort of fell apart. So I think they created a situation where they promised a great deal of things and delivered almost nothing.
Are they in better position now or with better management now?
Yes. Now they have an executive from Google, actually. Tim Armstrong is a very well-regarded executive, and he's really changed, has brought in new managers, many of them from Google, fascinatingly enough. And they've laid off a lot of people. And they're going to sell off assets. They're doing all the right things. It's just a question of what's left once they're finished doing that.
So do you think there's going to be an AOL in 5 years?
You know what? Everyone's always counting AOL out, and they still manage. They used to be called the cockroach of the internet, and they kind of still are in a lot of ways. You know, they never die. They always fall down. And it was their image that they constantly reinvented itself. And so we'll see. I mean, they have survived multiple changes in their business. Even before they got huge, they were almost out of business a million times. And so we'll see if cockroaches, whether you like them or not, probably will survive the nuclear holocaust. So we'll see. You know, we'll see what happens if they can turn this into something. It's not going to be the glory days of AOL before, but it could be something interesting.
Kara Swisher is co-executive editor of All Things Digital, a tech and media blog owned by Dow Jones. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.